This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
Hello and welcome to Season 5, Episode 3 of the Spooktator podcast. I'm Hayley Stevens and this is the podcast which examines the stranger elements of life, society, international culture and the media. I'm joined, as ever, by Paul Gannon and Charlie Revel-Smith.
Hello everyone.
Yo, down with the kids, hot mama. I'm just trying to mix things up and get it spicy, I'm sorry.
Spicy. Right.
I'm trying to talk like youth speak, aren't I? So it attracts a younger audience.
I've got a really good idea, Paul,
yeah.
On that front. Don't.
Don't do it. All right.
Yeah.
Well, God loves a trier.
You can find links to the things we discuss in this episode at www.spooktator.co.uk, where you'll also find ways to contact us, subscribe, or follow us on social media. There are also links on there to things like iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher, where you can leave us a review. Hint, hint. So, birthday boy gang, what have you guys been up to since we last spoke?
I'm currently in Chicago and it's the afternoon here and it is swelteringly hot in a really uncomfortable kind of city heat kind of way.
Shut up.
It actually really isn't pleasant. There's no air conditioning here. And they build Chicago houses thick, so they keep all the heat in during winter. So it has been almost unbearable to sleep here because the heat is just there constantly. And I'm really, really hoping that autumn is properly going to hit very soon. But other than that, I've been working on Weird Bristol and I've been preparing for American Halloween, which is the funnest thing in the world.
To where they do it right.
They really do it. They do it to such excess and it is just a glorious thing to witness.
See, I'm lamenting I can't go to Florida or California to go to the Universal Horror Nights because not only this year do they have a Ghostbusters experience maze, but they also have a Killer Clowns of Outer Space one, which is an amazing 80s movie.
Wow, yeah. That is going niche, that is.
I know it's surprisingly niche, but for whatever reason, I think last year they did a little trial of it and it was popular. So now they've got a whole dedicated maze to this weird 1980s comedy horror movie.
Yeah.
You say that it's niche, but I've actually seen Killer Clowns from Outer Space kind of popping up just on my social media, just people kind of talking about it. So I don't know, maybe if it's becoming like a trendy thing.
I think this year, the Halloween theme this year is absolutely clowns. They are everywhere.
Yeah.
They're really having
Pennywise.
Yeah.
All of that. Clowns are cool again, daddy-o.
Oh my God. Yeah, and you are not.
No, I know. I have finally gotten around to starting my book. That's exciting. And I'm panicking. And what else? Me and Eli are going on a ghost hunt for our Halloween special of Cheap Show. So that's going to be exciting too.
Ooh, where are you going ghost hunting? Or can you not tell
we're
us?
We're going... No, I've already said elsewhere, but we're going to Avenue House, which supposedly is like one of the most haunted houses in North London. Which, you know, what does that mean?
Okay.
But I did go to there a while ago and there were one or two interesting things that happened. So we'll see if we can recapture that and see how much Eli puts up with it.
Is Eli into ghost hunting? I mean,
no.
I know of Eli's existence. I know he's a person.
But yeah.
Obviously, our podcasts, like, the streams never cross.
No.
That was a Ghostbusters reference right there. So I don't really know. Is he into ghosts?
No, he's just excited because he goes, I want to get kitted up. Those were his words. So I think he wants the night vision goggles and the K2 meters and the hearing enhancers and he wants all of that stuff. And then he wants to complain about how it's not real, doesn't work all night.
Oh, I hate people who do this because they complain about how it's not real, like, duh, but then they want to play with it.
Yeah.
It's like role-playing.
So hopefully we'll have some fun. If it's anything like our past travelogue episodes, it'll be a random disaster.
What is supposed to haunt Avenue House?
I don't really remember. which says a lot. Here's the thing. the last time I went there, it was with another ghost tourism group. And there was a psychic there who I have genuinely forgotten the name of right now. But, you know, when basically, you get like 6 hours, don't you? 9 p.m. till 3 in the morning, something like that. And we all had a meet up and sit down, and we had the walk through and the safety precautions, and all it was all fine and dandy. And then the psychic came in and then spoke for an hour about his life, his career, the TV shows he'd been on, the police he'd helped, and then just talked about his life. And then the organizing group went, we've got to get on. We're running a bit behind time now. She went, oh. And then we walked around the house, and it was like a whistle-stop tour of the house. We went, there's a ghost, there's a ghost. Oh, I see a ghost there. Right, we're back in the room. And that was it. It was shit. It was just a crap psychic.
But and this time, are you guys on your own, or are you going as part of a ghost hunting?
No, we're going as part of a ghost hunting tourism thing with a group I've spoken with, which is absolutely fine. So I think that's the experience I want to give Eli. But at the same time, it's meant to be fancy dress, so I'm not telling Eli that.
Yeah, but in a way, he will be in fancy dress because he'll be dressing up as a ghost hunter.
Well, yes, true. Or if he doesn't do any effort at all and goes as he usually dresses, they'll just think he goes a scary tramp.
That's not very nice.
It isn't, but that's how Eli rolls.
Oh, dear. Tension. I haven't really been up to very much since we last recorded. Tell a lie. I've been working my day job. And then in the evenings, a couple of evenings, I have spent interviewing people who are going to be speaking at the Lapis Paranormal Conference. I'm speaking there, but in the last episode, we had an interview with the Reverend Peter Laws.
He wrote,
among other things, lots of other things. He has written a book called The Frighteners, which explores why we're all so fascinated with death and everything. And that was truly fascinating. I could have spoken to him for ages and ages, and I'm looking forward to seeing him speak. And
can I just say, he's way too handsome to be a reverend.
That's a very nice thing to say about somebody. Actually, you know, that's kind of like a backhanded compliment.
Yeah, well, I just don't know. I think of reverends and I think of buck-toothed, thin, white-haired, balding men who want sherry. And he looks like Captain Sexy. I don't like it.
He kind of, when I saw his profile photograph, he kind of reminded me a bit of Jesse Custer from Preacher.
Oh.
Holy cow. I've just seen a picture of him.
Yeah, see?
Yeah, you are right.
I don't think he's a reverend. I think he's a sexy man.
Goodness me.
Well, I was not expecting the discussion to go this way, but I think this is a really positive discussion. That's really lovely of you guys. And I'm sure his wife agrees. We have more interviews with speakers from the Lapis Conference coming up. This episode, for example, features an interview with a chap called Rob Gandy, who has conducted extensive research into phantom hitchhiker experiences across the UK and beyond. It's a really interesting chat, so listen on to hear that later on. And in future episodes, there are other interviews with speakers too. The people you may not have heard of, or you may have even heard of them, I don't know. That's not a diss against them, of course. But the thing that really strikes me about the Lapis Paranormal Conference is that there are a range of people speaking, and it's not necessarily what you would expect from a paranormal conference, in that it's not all people just going, oh, aliens are real and ghosts are real and look at this crystal skull and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The talks are kind of based in the reality of paranormal experiences and so on. Some really interesting stuff coming up, so do keep an ear out for those.
What's your talk going to be about? Do you mind asking?
My talk is a new talk that I'm doing. It's called The Trials and Tribulations of a Real-Life Ghostbuster.
Oh.
And my talk used to be called A Skeptic's Guide to Ghost Hunting. And it was all about exploring ghost hunting as a skeptic, as you might get from the, from the title. But the feedback that I used to get, even from the skeptic audiences, was that they wanted more scary stories. They wanted to hear the weird stories and the weird things I couldn't explain. And so I'm currently writing this new talk, Trials and Tribulations, and it's basically what I've learned over the years as a ghost researcher from both cases that I've been able to solve, but also those that I haven't been able to solve, and, you know, the weird things that I've experienced along the way. So that's the talk.
Exciting. You should record it and then put it out as a part of a podcast.
It's going to be the first time I deliver it, so it's premiering at the Lepers Conference. So it might be really shit, in which case I will not record it and put it out as part of the... We'll see what happens. Here is the second part of a collaboration between the Spooktator podcast and the Lancashire Anomalous Phenomena Investigation Society. Known best as Lapis, the group are hosting their 2019 Paranormal Conference in St Anne's, Lancashire on the 9th and 10th of November. Details and tickets can be found at lapisparanormal.com. That's lapisparanormal.com. I'll be delivering a brand new talk titled The Trials and Tribulations of a Real-Life Ghostbuster. And in the lead-up to the event, I'm interviewing my fellow speakers for the show. And for this show, I spoke to Rob Gandy, a 14 researcher with a keen interest in phantom hitchhiker phenomena. I understand that you collect first and second-hand stories of phantom hitchhikers and also road ghosts. How did this come about?
It came about by accident, like a lot of things in life. I'm going back to about 1990, and I was working in the Zachary Hospital, which is now Aintree Hospital, and I'd been reading a book called The Vanishing Hitchhiker, which is a book written by Professor Jan Brundvand in America, which is all about urban legends. And do you know the classic Phantom Hitchhiker story?
I've heard Phantom Hitchhiker stories. I don't know if it's the classic or if they're kind of twisted versions.
Yeah, well, the classic is that it's normally a young man is driving his car down the road, obviously often a rainy night, and there he sees to the left, thumbing a lift, a young lady normally, and so he stops and gives her a lift, and she says, "Oh, please take me to," gives an address, to Lacacia Avenue. They drive along for however long he knows where it is, and just as he's a few hundred yards short of Lacacia Avenue, he looks to his side and she's gone. She's not there. "Oh, good grief," he thinks. "What happened? How did she get out?" So he goes to number two, rings the bell, and the door's opened by this elderly couple. And he says, I was just going along Hangman's Lane or wherever it is. And I picked up this blonde lady and I was giving her a lift to this address, and then she's disappeared." And the old couple say, "Oh, you are the umpteenth young man who has picked up the ghost of our darling daughter who was killed on that very spot 20 years ago.
Right.
There's lots of permutations and combinations, but that's the general urban legend. And so I thought, oh, this is great stuff. And if anybody hasn't read it, get hold of the book, because it's excellent. There are lots of examples.
So how did you come about to sort of start collecting these testimonies?
Well, this was it. It was somebody's birthday, and in those days we all went down to the pub on a lunchtime and to celebrate. We got talking, and I said, "Oh, I'm reading this really good book, and it's Phantom Hitchhikers." And I told that story that I've, you know, outlined to you just. And much to my surprise, one of my colleagues said, "Well, actually, something like that happened to me." And I'm kind of, no, these are urban legends. These things don't happen in real life. Yeah. And he said, "Oh, yes, they do." And he told me the story. And I therefore chatted with him. And I thought, if you don't write these things down, then it'll just evaporate into the ether over time. So I managed to persuade him to tell me the story, or to repeat the story, so that I could write it down and submit it to Fortune Times, so that it was there for the record for if anybody was ever doing any research about it in the future.
Sure.
I got it in front of me. Bill, that's his pseudonym, was driving his Mini along Gregory's Lane in the direction of Ormskirk. That's between Southport and Ormskirk. It was about 11:30 on a Friday night in February or March 1965. The weather was clear, but it was pitch dark. As he neared the bridge over the disused railway, he looked in the car mirror and saw the figure of a large, elderly man, probably in his 70s, sitting in the back seat of his car. Bill looked long and hard enough to know his eyes were not playing tricks. There was a grey-white scarf around the man's neck in the style of a cravat, and Bill got the impression that he was wearing a flat cap. Bill was frightened and brought the car to a halt. Getting out of the car, he reached for the starting handle to defend himself, but when he looked, the man had vanished. Realising that there was no way the man could have got out of the Mini, Bill became even more scared, jumped in the back in the car and drove off at speed. He was certain it was not a trick of the light or an hallucination, but the whole thing was affirmed 6 or 7 years later when by chance he met a man at a social event who described having had exactly the same experience at exactly the same place. So I put that in and I thought, wow, you know, that's so good. And then about, where are we? It's 2019, isn't it? So
yeah.
5 years ago, in 2014, I realized that it was coming up to 50 years since this has happened to Bill. And I thought, I'd always wondered if anything had happened to other people, you know, in that area. But what you can't do is sort of go around a very large geographical area and knock on each door and say, excuse me, but you know, have you had any strange experiences? You'd be arrested pretty quickly, wouldn't you? I then had the idea that if I contacted the local freebie paper, I did a small piece saying, hi, you know, this Rob Gandy's had this story. He didn't give the whole of the story because what you don't want, and there's always a risk that people take it, they've not had anything happen to them, but they'll then play it back to you. So you have to be a bit careful with what information that you give. I thought if I got a couple of stories back, that'd be brilliant. I got 8 stories back.
Wow. I find that quite intriguing because I research the paranormal in my spare time. And whenever I do public talks, I get people coming up to me to tell me about their experiences. I just wondered, when you did your public appeal in the newspaper, how were you able to differentiate between people who were telling you about a genuine experience they'd had or something that they believed that they'd experienced, and those who might be pulling your leg or just kind of having a laugh?
I'd say that there was one that was a bit iffy, and I didn't include that. But in a lot of cases, I spoke to people, and you can tell talking to people. You ask questions, you know, a bit oblique, and if you say, like, what was the weather like, or, you know, this, that, and the other, if they pause and haven't thought about it, then you can get a bit suspicious. But in my experience, everybody is very genuine and very happy to be able to tell their story. And they can fill in the gaps because, as far as they're concerned, it did happen to them, whatever it was. I mean, I can't say exactly what the nature of the phenomenon was in each case. But what I can, I think, with surety say is that those people believe that they had had that experience. And in that case, all you can do is record it.
How common do you think these experiences are? Do you think more often than not people know what a phantom hitchhiker is? And do you get people approaching you at every talk you give, or if you mention it to people, do more people than you would imagine seem to have these stories?
That's a hard one to answer. But I was in conversation with Alan Murdy, who's the chairman of the Ghost Club, who writes in Fortune Times.
Yes.
Sometimes when I've been looking into some of these stories, I get in touch and pick his brains, and he's always very, very helpful, and he's an absolute encyclopedia. In a recent conversation I had with him, he said that there seemed to be a gradual diminution of reports of you know, of these sorts of sightings and whatever. And if I look at all the cases that I've collected, then given the extended period that we're talking about, and as I just mentioned, the data that I got was for about eight. Well, with later cases, I've got more cases. I've got about a dozen in that area now. And let's just say that they were all of the cases. Then that's over 50 years. That's one every 4 years, you know, kind of thing. So they're not happening all the time. And I had a conversation with a guy who's a professor of psychology at Liverpool University, who is a world expert on things like hypnosis and so on and so forth. Because I keep an open mind, I class myself as a Fortean. And I said to him, because several of the cases involved a man who looked like an elderly farmer, you know, dressed in rustic attire from like the turn of the century, which is probably about four or five of those cases, to which he said, what would you expect to see in the middle of the fields?
Yes.
So it's a bit like if you go down on the docks, you might expect to see sailors, sort of.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know is the answer, but the joy is actually in getting out there and researching. And I always use the term chasing the dragon. If you get a bit of a lead, follow it up.
Sure, yeah. Something that we've discussed on this podcast in the past, because we talk about the paranormal, but in the context of current media and the news and things that are happening now, also historic stuff, but mainly what, you know, things that have been in the news. And something we've spoken about a lot on the podcast is in the aftermath of the 2011 tsunami in Japan, a lot of taxi drivers reported that they would have customers come up to them and ask to be taken to parts of the shore, coastal towns and villages that had been ruined by the tsunami.
Yeah.
And they would get in the car, they'd be driving them to the destination, and when they looked in the mirror and they looked behind them, the passenger had gone. And rather touchingly, the taxi drivers more often than not would continue the journey, get to the destination and open the door for their passenger who disappeared.
Right.
Have you found that these stories happen across all different cultures? Are there similarities and differences?
Phantom hitchhikers are universal. I did an article about phantom hitchhikers on motorbikes, which I called uneasy riders. What I included in it was a piece that collected phantom hitchhiker on motorbike type cases from across the world. And they are universal. They happen everywhere. You know, they're usually always within the local cultural context. But I think there's a universality about this sort of phenomenon. There isn't necessarily a clear explanation. I mean, it might be that these stories that you just said, like in Japan, it could be urban legends. You know, somebody it happened to and they believed that it had happened to them, but maybe they were a bit confused, or somebody was telling a yarn, as the case may be, having read the same book as I read. And then these stories get repeated. There is a story about a taxi on Wellington Road North in Stockport doing exactly the same thing.
One thing that intrigues me about the phantom hitchhiker stories and legends is what would have come before cars existed. Do you think that there were similar stories before when there was different technology?
Coaches and horses, yes. Yeah, I mean, it is. They go back over the centuries before cars. They go into pony and traps the lot.
So would those stories have been stories of people kind of joining those vehicles as well, or were they slightly different?
As I understand it, I mean, without looking them up, but I've read of cases and the fact that there is a universality over the centuries with these things.
When it comes to these phenomena, do you think it has more to do with our expectations on the roads or something else? For example, I'm kind of I'm open-minded like yourself, but I do wonder if we see ghosts on the road, because roads are quite dangerous places, and we all know accident hotspots locally, and you see bouquets at the side of the road where people have been killed and so on. Do you think that kind of thing plays on our mind a lot, and that's why we see these apparitions, or do you think there's something more to it?
When you're driving along, and particularly if it's bad weather, it's the middle of the night, you're tired, and all that sort of thing. There's one of the stories, there's a particular stretch, and the lady who told me the story was a clinical psychologist who didn't believe in ghosts but was petrified out of her wits. When we were discussing it, she made the point that when you actually are in as she was, it was a black, rainy night, going through twisting lanes with sharp bends. Sometimes you over-concentrate. What you have to remember, when you look at something, your eyes don't see everything. What they do is they take out the main things of what they see in front of you. And that is then sent down the various tubes and wires to your brain, which fills in the gaps. And therefore, if you're in a bit of a stress situation, then that can actually trigger something in your mind.
So your talk at LAPIS, at the LAPIS Paranormal Conference...
It's nothing to do with phantom hitchhikers.
Could you tell us a little bit about what it's going to be about?
I'm looking to talk about three particular subjects. The first one will be the Mandela effect, whereby people, or a fair number of people, share memories which are patently false. The second part, or the middle part, will be about global transient amnesia, how this might shed some light on missing time. There might actually be an explanation behind that, and I will be feeding on a personal experience on that. I have not been probed by aliens. I will stress that from the start. But it's far more down to earth. And then the final section, which I think very fascinating, is cellular memory. People receive donor organs, and then they take on some of the characteristics of the donor. There are examples of this, and some of them I think are extremely, some of them are very, make your mind go like, wow, how can that be?
I've got so many questions about that, but I'm not going to ask them, because I would love for our listeners to come and see your talk at the LAPIS Paranormal Conference.
Well, I thank you. I have said I hope it will be unforgettable, but that's
oh, that's terrible. Finally, Rob, where can people learn more about you and your work and your research if they want to?
Most of my articles that I've had published are in Fortean Times,
cool,
which I'm totally biased. I think is the best magazine on the planet.
I like it too. I agree. It's a very good magazine.
If people want to get in touch with me and have queries, or even better, have their own stories about their experiences, then if they get in touch with you, Hayley, then you can put them in touch with me.
Absolutely. So if anyone listening does have anything they want to share, as always, you can email me at spooktater@gmail.com, and we'll be more than happy to pass them on. That was Rob Gandy, one of the speakers for the LAPIS Paranormal Conference, which takes place on the 9th and 10th of November in Lancashire. Buy your tickets at lapisparanormal.com. That's LAPIS paranormal.com. I might see you there. Have you guys ever heard of the Stambovsky versus Ackley case?
No. It rings a bell, but not, no.
We briefly discussed it back in Season 2, Episode 3, when we spoke about the Watcher case. Completely unrelated case, but I made some incorrect sort of links, which we got caught up on. But anyway, it's usually referred to as the Ghostbusters ruling. The case was taken to the New York Supreme Court in 1991, and it was essentially ruled that the house in question is, or at least was, legally haunted. The home was owned by Helen Ackley, who lived there from the 1960s through to the 1980s when she sold it. And Ackley claimed that ghosts, potentially from the Revolutionary War era, were haunting her home. And in a 1977 story published in Reader's Digest, Ackley asserted that ghosts regularly interacted with the family, including waking up her daughter each morning by shaking her bed. She was sued by Jeffrey Stambofsky, who had entered into a contract to buy the house in the late 80s, because he claimed Ackley neglected to inform him of the supposed paranormal presence in the home. The legal battle was eventually won by Stambofsky, because the court ruled that Ackley should have told him about the ghost activity that was in the property that he had the intention to buy. Now, 28 years later, that legally haunted house is back on the market.
Oh.
Interestingly, since the infamous legal case, many different people have lived in the home, and none of them have reported any paranormal happenings at all, which to some might suggest that Ackley was telling tall tales about the things going on in her home, or at least that the phenomena was person-based, so something about her and her family made them perceive things to be paranormal when they may not have been. Not only that, but more interestingly, to me at least, the real estate agent who is selling the mansion says that this is the third sale of the mansion that she has personally overseen. And despite having spent a considerable amount of time there in her job, she says, and I quote, "I've never experienced anything that would lead me to feel that it's haunted." Now, nonetheless, the court's designation still stands. It's a legally haunted house. So if you've got a spare $1.9 million sitting around, you could own your very own legally defined haunted house.
Can I ask a quick question? Could you theoretically then buy the house and then sue the people saying it's not haunted when they promised it would be, or stated that it would be?
I do wonder about that. That's a really good question, because this law, this ruling, only applies to New York. But it does make you wonder if it's being marketed as haunted and then nothing happens, do you feel a bit shortchanged?
I would.
Call it on that basis. I think the same question could possibly be raised, not necessarily legally, when it comes to the cage in Essex, the alleged witch's prison that's said to be haunted, which is currently on the market. If you were to buy that house because of the paranormal expectation in the advertising and then nothing happened, where would that leave you as a buyer?
With a slightly narrow corner house.
Yeah, and a really weird back alley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating, though. In the first place, I'm surprised that it was even made a legally haunted house. I still don't fathom the idea of what proof they could have had to make it a legally haunted house.
I don't think it's necessarily that they were like, "Ah, here is the evidence that this house is haunted."
Okay.
I think from what I can gather, and I'm not a legal expert, obviously, but from what I can gather, it was that before selling the house and in the lead up to selling it, Ackley had made many claims in the media, had kind of sold her story, as far as I can tell, to not only Reader's Digest, but other magazines or news outlets, claiming that the house was haunted. And therefore, as far as she was concerned, as the seller of the house, it was an actively haunted home. And she didn't disclose those scary and paranormal things to the buyer. And therefore, if you are, I guess, buying a house, you would want to, I guess you would want to know. So this guy obviously felt that he had information withheld from him. And I think it was claimed that it was legally defined as a haunted house because of the claims that she had been making before she sold the home.
So it was less the fact that it was a haunted house and more the fact that he was sold an ill bill of goods or something like that.
Something like that, I think, yeah.
How
but
strange.
She seemed to genuinely believe the house was haunted but didn't mention.
Yeah, or at least that she had promoted or publicised it as being haunted by going to the media and hadn't told a potential buyer about it, which
suggests to me it's bullshit.
Well, I can understand, like, in a way that you might actually want to know if it was, like, famously haunted and you're going to be, have people knocking on your door all, you know, all times night and day wanting to have a look around the house. That might not be the kind of house you want to buy.
And that kind of goes back to, so the interview that I did with Peter Laws very recently and the discussion that we had about haunted houses being sold for cheaper. Peter Laws mentioned the Dennis Nielsen flat that was sold and how that went for cheaper than it normally would have done because of the association. We also discussed how some young people are buying allegedly haunted real estate, which is sold for cheaper. So I guess, in a way, I guess maybe you could argue that if somebody is selling you a house that they believe is haunted and they've publicized it in a way that's like, oh, this ghost is negatively affecting our family, you have a right to know that there's something that's negatively affected the people living in a house, maybe, and maybe that therefore the price should be cheaper. I don't know.
It's a strange one.
It is.
Because it kind of seems like the emphasis is put on superstition somewhat.
Yeah, it does. It's weird. It is weird. I'm sure that there are listeners who know more about it, so, you know, do feel free to get in touch if we've made any incorrect assumptions.
So how long until Yvette Fielding buys it, or Zach Baggins?
I was literally just going to say, which begs the question, how much money are you guys willing to bet that Zach Baggins is going to buy this house? Because he does seem to have a reputation for doing this sort of thing.
Yeah, he certainly
does. He's
like
the supernatural version of a person who flips houses, except in his case he likes to burn them to the ground or something. What did he do to the house? Did he get it demolished?
I think so, yes.
Oh, what a shame. Could have been a nice Airbnb, that.
Well, I think you said that that house went for 1.9 million, which, strangely enough, is exactly the price which, well, almost exactly the price which Zach Baggins did buy a house. This was, actually mentioned early in the year as being a potential sale that Zach Baggins, the presenter of Ghost Adventures, among other shows, was going to buy a very famous house in the Los Feliz area of Los Angeles for just shy of $1.9 million. In fact, I think you could kind of open up to, like, this is why after, like, the Myra Hindley thing that we discussed a couple of episodes back, you know, of paranormal investigators going in search of the mysteries of Myra Hindley, I think that you could call this, what tasteless crap are paranormal researchers up to now? And Zach Baggins has, as of the 30th of September 2019, has closed on a deal to buy the LaBianca House in Los Angeles, which was notorious for the murders of Leno and Rosemary LaBianca, who were murdered by six members of the Manson family.
Oh, it's that house, the Once Upon a Time in America, a Hollywood thing that's popular at the moment.
Sort of. That was the Tate House was the one with the, you know, like the mass party murder.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm getting confused. Which one's this one? Sorry.
This is the LaBianca House, which was, I think it was a couple of days later when six members of the family broke into the house and it seemingly just randomly targeted this couple and murdered them. Absolutely right. Brutally. It's possible that the Manson family might have known about the house because the couple had reported waking up one day and realizing that their furniture had been moved during the night, and on another occasion that their dogs had been let out into the garden during the night. And the Manson family were notorious for doing what they called creepy crawls, which is where they would just sneak into a person's house at night and just rearrange furniture.
Nice.
And, you know, and do nothing else but just to freak people out. Could you imagine how terrifying that would be? Just coming downstairs in the morning and realizing that your living room had just been completely rearranged. Nothing had been stolen. It had just been moved about. Horrifying. This couple were brutally murdered with absolutely no sense or reason behind it. And the house was has been passed through hands during time. The Tate House, or the Tate Polanski House, where Sharon Tate, J.C. Bring, and a few other guests were murdered, that actually stayed up until sometime in the mid to late 90s. And it had served as a music studio for edgelord musicians. They could kind of like really give themselves an edge by recording in the Tate House. But the Bianca House had sort of just gone on being this very, you know, really quite luxurious house in Los Feliz, and, you know, has just passed from owner to owner and had not had the same notoriety that the Tate House had up until now, when Zach Baggins has bought this house, which is notorious for this horrendous double murder, completely senseless, brutal violence. And we are just going to have to wait and see what he does to it, because I just have a feeling it is not going to be something tasteful, going by his previous work.
Is Ghost Adventures still being like filmed and broadcast? Do you think it will end up on an episode of that?
It could quite possibly be, but I would imagine that with a kind of investment like this, he's going to look to make another like feature-length documentary that he did with his previous home that he built.
Oh, God.
I would think that, and, you know, as you can imagine, just how horribly tasteless it's going to be about a somewhat recent double murder. And I say recent in as much as there will be people who...
It's in living memory, yeah.
Yeah, there will be people around who knew the LaBiancas as living people rather than as creepy ghost stories. And I just think that it's horribly, horribly tasteless to exploit a murder like that and to profit from murder generally.
I think it's really invasive as well upon the memories of the deceased that people who are still alive have.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, it would be nice to imagine that Zach Baggins is just going to move into this house and not exploit its history in any way. But we know from previous things that he's done that that's just not going to happen.
Maybe this is me giving him the benefit of the doubt that he doesn't deserve. I don't know. But quite often people who are involved in paranormal research, who they sometimes have this kind of mentality where they think that they're going in to help a situation. So where there's been tragedy, they go in and they will do their ghost hunts or their investigations and get their evidence, and they feel like they're doing something positive to help the spirits who are trapped. There was a case, I remember when I first kind of started out as a ghost hunter back in, 2005? I think maybe there was this case in 2006 or 2007, the years that followed that, where this local ghost hunting team in a different town, they went into a pub where the previous landlady had taken her life by shooting herself. And when they did the ghost hunt, they brought all of this up. So the psychic had obviously done his research beforehand. It was in all the newspapers. And the really horrible thing was that they publicised what they had done by going to the papers afterwards. And I can remember, this was like a really early on lesson for me as a ghost hunter about what you do and do not do, because I remember even then, as someone who believed in hunted ghosts, reading the comments under the newspaper article about their ghost hunt from family members of this woman who had died just a few years ago. And that was horrendous. But I honestly think those people had the best intentions at heart. They were just completely misguided.
Yeah.
Maybe Zach Baggins is like that. Maybe he's not.
I think that that's probably giving Zach Baggins probably a bit more leeway than he actually deserves, because it's sort of suggesting that he is unaware of what he's doing, and I don't think that that's the case this time around. I'm sure there are ghost investigators who aren't aware that they have actually crossed the line into doing something horribly tasteless, but I think he knows what he's doing, and I would go as far as saying that I don't believe that he believes in ghosts to begin with, but he knows that it is a marketing opportunity.
See, for me, I get the impression that he's like a hoarder, like of supernatural tat. It's like, because you know he has the museum now in Las Vegas.
And
he bought the Charlie Manson death smock or whatever it was, the thing he was wearing when he was electrocuted. It feels to me like he wants to be associated within the world by having, like, he wants to be the P.T. Barnum of it, or the Ripley's Believe It or Not of ghosts.
Yeah.
I think that's how he sees it. And I don't, There's been no report that I could find online of the property that he's bought being haunted, but it's notorious for that one thing. And so to buy it for that one reason seems to focus on that sole part of his interest in the property rather than, you know, whether he makes a show out of it or not. It just seems to me like it's like having a Panini sticker album. It's like, oh, I've got that now. Great. What else can I get?
Yeah, maybe he feels that his way of staying relevant or being interesting is through the shock factor.
Well, I just never find him interesting anyway because he speaks like a West Coast Gregorian chant. It's just like this whole kind of mono. I hate him. I hate him and I hate his show.
It's one of those things I've found absolutely unwatchable about his documentary is just the tone of voice and the kind of fake sincerity behind it. So it's like, I'm not believing any of this.
Yeah. In his honour, I've actually created, and this is how totally awesome and cool that I am, I have created a Zach Baggins word search for our listeners to complete.
Did you just write the word douche 42 times in a block?
Well, I almost did include the word douche. The word hair gel is in there. So if you go to www.spooktator.co.uk, you will find the Zach Baggins word search that you can download and complete. And I think I may have taken a bit of a wrong gamble here in assuming that our listeners are the kind of people who do word searches. Maybe I'm just a
I certainly am.
Really immature 32-year-old woman or a really old-fashioned... I don't know. Is it young people who do word searches or old people?
That's right. Ask me.
But anyway, yeah. Go and do our Zach Baggins word search and see how you fare and tweet us your photos of your completed words. No, don't, because then that will help other people do it. Yeah, keep it to yourself.
We're working the concept out, everyone. Stay with us.
Yeah, do the word search. I don't know.
Also on the Spooktator Facebook group, a few weeks back, I posted a Spooktator jigsaw puzzle. And I think that the record for completion time is about 8 minutes. It took me about a quarter of an hour to do it myself. And I was the one who designed it.
8 minutes? I did the Spooktator jigsaw puzzle several times and I'm going to find it because this is really important. Bear with.
I did it several times and got worse with each progressive attempt.
I've been too busy playing Zelda.
Hang on, let me find it. I'm going to read off some of the times.
Here we go.
I have to.
It's like a leaderboard. Really
good. This is, you know... This is my validation in society. Like, oh, look, she's really fast at a jigsaw puzzle. So you say 8 minutes there, but actually one chap called Jeremy completed it in 4 minutes, 37 seconds.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. A listener called Alistair completed it in 4 minutes, 22 seconds. And that, Alistair, started my competitive streak because I then did it in 3 minutes, 42 seconds.
What?
Yes. And then you did it in 14 minutes, 53 seconds, Charlie. So
this is all very sad to hear.
Practice makes perfect, Charlie. This has been another episode of the Spooktator podcast. Remember, you can find links to everything that we've discussed at www.spooktator.co.uk, where you can also find links to our social media accounts and give us a follow or drop us a review in the places that you can subscribe to the show. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, remember, spooky is in the eye of the beholder. Coming soon to the Spooktator podcast.
Do you believe what you're seeing? Do you believe what you're being told by the television? Do you believe what you're being told by the newsreader? Do you believe the factual information of a caption that comes up telling you something? Well, if all those things are suddenly questioned, you know, it became a really interesting kind of landscape, because What do you believe becomes something that's connected to the media and also, obviously, a ghost story?